Here we are in the middle of the 4th of July weekend, a time set aside to celebrate the birth of our nation. 240 years ago, a group of brave men signed a document declaring independence from England. One war later, we had ourselves a new country, the United States of America. I suspect everyone here is, as I am, proud to be an American and grateful to our founding fathers for their courage and wisdom in laying the foundation for what was then a unique experiment in government. Ours is a country rooted in high ideals. It was to be a classless society where everyone was equal under the law, with equal opportunity to grow and prosper. Justice and liberty were the bywords of the day. We were free from tyranny and free to worship as we pleased. It was an exciting, heady adventure in governing this new democracy. Amazingly, nearly 2.5 centuries later, our country is still here, a little battered and worse for wear, but still flourishing. We survived a horrific civil war, economic depressions and recessions, world wars and cold wars, natural disasters, and growing pains. It hasn't always been easy. In fact, it's never been easy. But ours is a good system worth the hard work. Our country requires conscientious citizens, willing to think clearly and act responsibly in order to survive. If too many of us become complacent or self-centered and unable to make informed, hard decisions, we could lose our greatness. The United States could even cease to be, with this grand experiment of our founding fathers ending in disaster. So we, as United States citizens, have a big responsibility to get it right. We need to take our civic obligations seriously. Yet, as important as that is, we who are Christians have it even harder because no matter how much we love our country, we love God more. We may pledge allegiance to the United States of America, and we should, but our first allegiance is and always will be to the God of the universe, our Creator and Savior. We find ourselves in this world, smack dab in the middle of what is often called the greatest country on earth, and boy are we lucky. But we can't lose our focus. We can't be blinded by stars and stripes in our eyes. This isn't our home. We're only passing through. We may have our marching orders to make this the very best place we can while we're here, but we're bound for glory. We are subjects of the King of Kings, the Lord Most High. Our first loyalty is to Him. So how do we go about the business of being good United States citizens, working hard to make our country the best it can be, and yet keeping our sights firmly set on God? That's what I want to talk about this morning. It's a topic I actually started a few months ago when I last preached. I talked about truth, pointing out that it exists and is of the utmost importance to God. Scriptures emphasize over and over again how much God hates lies and condemns liars. We can see why this is so when we consider that God Himself is truth, and He is in each of us. When we lie, we are denying Him, thereby diminishing His presence in us. It's that serious. So where to start in figuring out the behavior as Christians, as good citizens? I always like to make sure we're all on the same page of the dictionary by understanding important terms that we'll be using. Let's start with something very basic. The word government almost seems too elementary to need defining, but I'm not so sure it is. I hear people referring to the government as if it were an evil force with its own power unleashed among us. Maybe it almost seems that way sometimes, but it isn't. The word government has several nuances of meaning, but basically it is a political direction and control exercised over the actions and affairs of the members of communities, societies, or states, and the people who administer this control. In the United States, rather than having a dictator or a monarch, we practice representative democracy. So the people who administer our form of government are elected or are appointed by or hired by our elected officials. The truth is that government is absolutely necessary to the existence of a civilized society. We need centralized structure. If we didn't have someone or a group of someones coordinating our infrastructure, creating and enforcing our laws, protecting our citizenry, and providing for our general well-being, we'd have chaos. Basically, in our country, we have some people working for all the people. Does it always come together perfectly? Of course not. Remember, I said government is made up of people. But it is our responsibility to keep an eye on these people who make up our government so it will run as smoothly, as fairly, and as honestly as possible. That's where elections come in, and we're about to have a big one. We, as U.S. citizens and Christian women and men, have a responsibility to try to get it right. The Bible has a few things to say about our role as citizens, but on the whole, we're left to work out our response to current events using fundamental Christian principles, keeping in mind that even though our 21st century world is a long way from ancient Palestine, what God expects from us is timeless. However, one thing is apparent in both Old and New Testaments. God insists it is the duty of government to seek justice. In Jeremiah 22:1-3, we read, God's orders, go to the royal palace and deliver this message. Say, listen to what God says, O King of Judah, you who sit on David's throne, you and your officials and all the people who go in and out of these palace gates. This is God's message. Attend to matters of justice. Set things right between people. Rescue victims from their exploiters. Don't take advantage of the homeless, the orphans, the widow. Stop the murdering. The Old Testament law of Moses saw justice as a complex entity comprised of criminal justice and distributive justice. The latter subdivided into laws about fairness and laws about giving aid to the needy. We know that Jesus preaches over and over again the importance of helping the needy. He enjoins us to love our neighbor, to hate sin but love our enemies, to do unto others as we would want them to do unto us, and to be an example of Christ on earth to a fallen world. But what about our relationship to government? In 1 Peter 2:11-17, we read, Friends, this world is not your home, so don't make yourself cozy in it. Don't indulge your ego at the expense of your soul. Live an exemplary life among the natives so that your actions will refute their prejudices. Then they'll be won over to God's side and be there to join in the celebration when he arrives. Make the master proud of you by being good citizens. Respect the authorities, whatever their level. They are God's emissaries to keep order. It is God's will that by doing good, you might cure the ignorance of the fools who think they're a danger to society. Exercise your freedom by serving God, not by breaking the rules. Treat everyone you meet with dignity. Love your spiritual family. Revere God. Respect the government. It would seem that human systems of government are God's method of securing certain purposes. A just government should provide and protect a framework for good people to lead peaceful, productive lives. To do so, a system of laws, enforcement, and punishments needs to exist. If we want to enjoy the benefits of such a system of protection and laws, we have to be willing to accept the obligations and responsibilities such a system requires. It provides a bedrock for the important task of securing justice for all, God's earthly goals for us. We like to call ourselves a Christian nation. In truth, the Founding Fathers were not purposefully laying out a Christian blueprint. Many of them were deists or non-believers. They were, however, trying to establish a nation where anyone could practice his or her religion in peace. Yet, in spite of whether they intended a Christian nation or not, the reality is that the virtues that they incorporated into the foundation of our country are very Christian in origin. Truth, justice, mercy, freedom, equality, rights of the individual. Every one of these ideals comes right out of the pages of the New Testament and were a part of the religious and cultural mindset of the Western world in the 18th century. So if we are in truth a Christian nation, we should hold these ideals high and act on them. It's up to us as Christian voters to perpetuate them and keep them in the forefront of public consciousness. That being said, we also have a duty to resist trying to turn all our Christian beliefs into laws binding on all citizens, Christians and non-Christians alike. There is a difference between forbidding acts we all agree damage others, like murder and theft, and forbidding acts that we perceive as displeasing God. I'm afraid this can get a little tricky. We are mindful that we are Christians, Christ's representatives here on earth, yet we also have to be mindful that we can't legislate the human heart. In the not-so-distant past, Christians pushed through legislation outlawing the sale of alcoholic beverages, closing businesses on Sunday, forbidding married women to teach children, to name a few examples. We probably smile to ourselves at how blue-nosed they were, as we stop at Dillon's to pick up a gallon of milk after lunching at Whiskey Creek this afternoon. But how about forbidding gay marriage? Fretting about transgender people in bathrooms or outlawing Muslim immigration? We're getting personal here. It's not always easy for a Christian to know what to do. So how do we go about finding the right answers, doing the right thing, while honoring our Christian values and obligations? I think the very first place to start is not to immediately assume we know the answer and then snap our minds tight shut like a bear trap. Obviously, there are sometimes occasions when the answer is clear. Solving the excess population problem by sending everyone over 65 into the wilderness to die, for example, I immediately knew that was wrong. But it's amazing how often we're mistaken when we jump to conclusions. We need to open our minds, study the facts, listen to opposing views, pray for guidance, and then make a decision. We'll possibly find it wasn't as easy to do as we thought it would be, because finding the truth isn't necessarily easy. We want it to be, of course, and once in a while it is, but usually not. Beware the quick, simple answer, because too often it is merely simplistic rather than correct. My husband often points out, when people are too eager for the quick fix, that if you think about it, you realize that the more you know about a subject, the more you understand that there are nuances, complicated circumstances, what-ifs, variables. Here's an example. Several of you work with children. Marcy, Lori, Billy, Terry, Miss Carolyn. You've undoubtedly heard often, "What this generation needs is a good trip to the woodshed like we got when I was a kid. That straightened us out pretty darn quick." My guess is you roll your eyes, because even putting aside the ethical issue of whether it's morally right to hit children, you know that disciplining is not that simple. There are children who would be traumatized for life by a switch on their bare legs. There are also children who would consider a thrashing to be nothing more than an annoying interruption in their pursuit of corruption and mayhem. So you try distracting them when you notice a child in the early stages of some forbidden activity. One young thing is quickly diverted by the introduction of a different toy or puzzle. Another, who has her mind determinedly set on some forbidden delight, would not be distracted by the arrival of an ice cream truck. A few children are racked with remorse by a slight frown and a little shake of the head from you. Others find your disapproval a good indicator that whatever they are up to is definitely worth pursuing. You also know that you can have children who are putting up with a rough patch at home, children who are malnourished, maybe actually hungry. You may have a child who is a little slow to pick up on what's going on around him. Or perhaps little Caitlin badly needs her nap. In other words, how to discipline a child does not have an easy, one-size-fits-all answer. The truth is that the appropriate discipline probably varies minute to minute, child to child, and takes training, experience, and patience to get right. So, beware the simple answer. Closely related and also to be wary of is the fallacy of black and white thinking. Oh, how we are attracted to it. It is so much easier for us if one thing is completely right and the other completely wrong. We don't have to contend with those pesky shades of gray working up everything. But the truth is, problem situations are very, very rarely straightforward. Yes or no, right or wrong, go or stay, etc. Think of your own life. How many major decisions do we make that we aren't tortured with indecision? Should we get a new vehicle or put a little money into the old one and drive it a little while longer? But what if the transmission goes out and it's about due to? Then again, new car payments are outrageous, plus there'd be taxes and insurance to consider. So maybe we look into finding a used car. Ah, but you know, you don't know what you're getting with a used car. Wait a minute, perhaps it would be smarter to get a van this time. And so it goes. But eventually you make a decision. You may feel fairly certain that it was the best one under the circumstances. Yet you also know it may not have been. With so many variables and what-ifs, how could you know for sure? If this kind of gray exists in the decisions we make in our personal lives, why would it not be present in the decisions that need to be made on the world stage? Black and white thinking is too often the refuge of the person who doesn't want to study the issues. This sort of study usually isn't easy. It can be confusing, complicated, and even disturbing. Perhaps we find ourselves leaning a direction we don't want to go, and that's frightening. But remember, we have an obligation to get as close to the truth as we possibly can. If we succumb to the easy answer, the quick fix, we're shortchanging our responsibilities and becoming part of the problem rather than the solution. Another mistake we too easily fall into is allowing excess emotionalism to cloud our judgment. True, we are all emotional creatures, and we need to be. It's important to know when to be afraid, for example. We want to feel joy, to express sorrow. But when we start letting emotion make our decisions for us, we lose all objectivity. Emotion pounds in our ears so loudly that reason is drowned out completely. This is a dangerous situation. At the worst possible level, it spawns lynch mobs. Latino shop windows have been broken, black churches bombed, Muslim mosques torched. You might object that you don't do those horrible things, but if you allow hate or fear or prejudice or envy or bitterness to overwhelm reason, then you are as guilty as if you had. We can't let nostalgia for the past or sentimentalism for what could have been drive our decisions for today. We need to be clear-eyed enough to realize what is happening with us and hard-nosed enough to fight down our emotions when they threaten to overcome our judgment. God did not give us minds for nothing. We have to use them to keep our emotions in check. Fortunately, in this quagmire of fact-checking and decision-making, a light shines through the murky gray, the light that is always shining for us, no matter what our problems and decisions are, and that light is Jesus. God has done something wonderful for us. He has given us Jesus, the light of the world, the fount of all wisdom, the great healer. When we're uncertain which direction to turn or which path to take, we look for him. I'm not saying that the answer will pop up in neon, but in the looking, we start down the path to truth. It's amazing how often, if we sincerely ask, what would Jesus do? The answer does become clear. It should be the mantra of our whole lives. What would Jesus do? What would Jesus say? The more we seek the answer to these two questions, the closer we come to real truth. That's why I'm so troubled when a candidate announces, for instance, that he's going to bring back waterboarding if elected, that he'll do worse than waterboarding, that in fact, he'll also torture and kill the relatives of suspected terrorists and other enemies. Many Christians support this man, and yet I cannot imagine those horrible words coming out of Jesus' mouth. Some Christians say, well, he may not be perfect in all ways, but we need to consider the whole picture. It seems to me that the whole picture, the bottom line, is saving our souls, not saving our country. Jesus says, what does it profit a man to gain the whole world but lose his soul? We are citizens of heaven first and United States citizens second, and we have to remember it. Not that I believe that by setting aside our Christian values, we will in the long run save our country. No nation that turns its back on God can survive. True greatness can only be built on goodness. Which brings me to another matter that is troubling me. We can't forget that we are Christian brothers and sisters either, no matter what we believe about politics. Some issues seem to be so emotionally charged that even Christians are allowing their feelings to overcome their judgment. In Matthew 5:25 and following, we're commanded by Jesus not to be angry with a brother or sister, not to call them names. Yet I have been called indirectly some pretty ugly names by some of you. Bathroom things, various body parts, questionable parentage, doubtful intelligence. You get the picture. The reason for all this revilement is that I support gun control legislation. Obviously a hot, controversial topic. I'll tell you why I support it. I believe that some people have no business having guns and no right to own them. People on the no-fly lists, terrorists, people with serious mental illness, criminals, people with a history of violence. I don't want them to be able to buy weapons. I also don't think that civilians need to own weapons of war. That does not mean that I think no one should own guns. Responsible people who want hunting weapons or weapons for self-defense have every right to buy them and maintain them. No one wants to take away guns from responsible people. No one wants to outlaw them completely. No one blames individual gun owners for the acts of terrorists, nor does anyone think passing gun legislation will eliminate all violence. We just want to make it harder for the wrong people to have guns in the hope that it will save some innocent lives. As an American citizen, I have the right to this opinion, just as you have the right to disagree with me. That as Christians, we don't have the right to call each other names. In fact, we don't have the right to call anyone names. We are all made in the image of Christ with his spark in us. Consequently, we can't hate, and we can't be hateful. So no matter how wrong-headed you and I may think each other, no matter how passionate we are about an issue, we have to behave civilly towards each other. It is possible to grit your teeth and still love someone. God commands it. A commonly seen bumper sticker slogan reads, "Freedom is not free." It's referring to our armed forces, our indebtedness to them, for the sacrifices in their sacrifices in the cause of liberty. But it is a sentiment that we should all take to heart. If we want our country to remain a nation dedicated to liberty and justice for all, then we have to do our part. We can't sit back and coast, expecting that everything will be business as usual. We need to stay informed, to be conscious of injustices, and work to stamp them out. We need to be vigilant in our effort to help those less fortunate, mindful of the rights of everyone, not just those people who look like us. We must question what we hear and read. We can't assume because we heard it on Fox News or NPR or read it on Facebook that whatever it said is true. Worse yet, we can't assume it's true because we want it to be true. God has given us the task of making this world the best place we can make it be. It's not our final home, but He's here in us, urging us to make ourselves and everything around us worthy of the great honor He's bestowed on us, to be His hands and feet to a needy world. William Barclay, the great British Bible scholar, summed it up well. He said, "Christian freedom does not mean free to do as we like, but free to do as we ought. Christianity is community. Only in Christ is a man so freed from self and sin that he can become as good as he ought to be." We're very fortunate to be part of this grand country, this majestic experiment in a way of life dedicated to the Christian virtues of liberty, justice, mercy, honor, charity, and grace. Let's do our part to keep it great. God bless the United States of America.
You've been listening to a message presented at Hayes Christian Church. Hayes Christian Church is a non-denominational fellowship in Hayes, Kansas. We are supported by the generosity of our members, attenders, and friends. The financial support we raise goes to projects which further spread the gospel to those who do not yet know Jesus, to local, national, and international missions, and they help to keep these podcasts free. If you'd like to share a monetary gift with us, please visit our webpage at hayeschristianchurch.org and click on the donate button. Or you may mail your gift to P.O. Box 1111, Hayes, Kansas 67601. If you have questions, comments, or would like more information, we would love to hear from you. Simply go to our webpage and click on the Contact Us form. Thank you for your generosity, and may God bless you as you seek to follow Him.